This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Is a thing. You're listening to The Kevin Kelly Show, exclusively here on placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. And now, here's your host, the voice of Ring of Honor, Mr. Kevin Kelly.
Here we know that Christmas will be green and bright, the sun to shine by day.
Merry Christmas! Happy New Year! Welcome, everybody, to the Kevin Kelly Show. It's episode 24. We've made it through the entire calendar year. And this is the one. This is the episode that we've all been waiting for. You found the Kevin Kelly Show here on the Place to Be Nation. The website, placetobenation.com. And whether you've ventured to us through the iTunes, doesn't matter how you found it, as long as you're here, because this is the one. This is the episode that everybody has been asking for. You know, when I said this is the one we've all been waiting for, man, if I had a dollar for every time I said that as a professional wrestling announcer over the last 23 years, I'd be a pretty rich man. But this is the one we've all been waiting for. Why? Because of our special guest tonight. Our special guest on this episode is Dennis Stamp.
He's booked. He's involved. He's here.
He is booked, baby. I love it.
He sniffed around the studios, and we let him in.
This was hard work. This was not an easy booking. A lot of times, I'm not going to lie. I got a lot of friends. It's pretty easy. You call them up or you ask them when you see them, hey, could you come on the show? Yeah, sure, no problem. We've had no cancellations. We've had one slight change with Mark Briscoe, who we'll get back on in 2015. DDP was kind of an exercise, but that's okay. But anyway, this was one that was like, how do we get this guy? How do we find him? Because we wanted to have Dennis Stamp on as a guest. Probably since like the first couple episodes, right?
I think it was literally one of the first couple that we first mentioned it. And Scott and I have been talking about trying to get him on some sort of podcast with Place to Be Nation for years now. I mean, he's been a cult favorite for all of us. So very excited tonight.
Yeah, this is good. And talking with Dennis, when I set up the interview with him Sunday night, man, he's an interesting character. That's for sure. And there's no one else like him in the world. I have run across a lot of people in my time. I've talked to a lot of great folks. Dennis is great. He's a fantastic guy. You're going to hear that this is going to be an interview like no other. I promise you this, fans. This is one they'll be talking about tomorrow. There's another cliche that I wish I had a dollar every time I said it. It's like going to the bank, you know?
As the Monsoon Classic Twitter account said, it's going to be a happening.
It's going to be a happening. Absolutely. At Fake Gorilla, thank you for your support on Twitter. And I want to thank everybody on Twitter that follows us, either me at Real Kevin Kelly or at Place to Be Nation, because the feedback and everything that we've been getting about the podcast throughout the year has just been really remarkable, and we thank you. We thank you, thank you, thank you for your support, for your tweets, for all the goodwill and wishes that you've sent our way. We've had a blast every step of the way. We're going to have a lot of fun tonight. We'll do the Dennis Stamp interview. We'll talk about some stuff. We'll do our trending stories like we usually do. We'll play a special game. We'll review what we didn't get Dan McGinn for Christmas, because JR, I can say pretty much it's unanimous. Neither of us got Dan anything, right?
I may get him a penis or something.
Well, that.
Well, he's like Paris Hilton all of a sudden. He totes his dog around to all these parties, around these socialite of Marlboro.
The the sad thing is that the dog is more over than he is. Yeah.
Not as much of a bitch as Dan is, though.
Well, that's again, you've made two insulting comments about him, and all I've said was that his dog is much more popular than he is. That's it.
That's true.
Well, anyway, so let's not waste any more time. We'll get Dennis on the phone here in a second. While I'm dialing, JR, please tell everybody where they can find the Kevin Kelly Show.
Sure. Any of the following ways. PlaceToBeNation.com. You can click up the Kevin Kelly Show banner or the PTBN podcast banner on the right-hand side. You can subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed in iTunes or visit Stitcher.com. Subscribe to the Place to Be podcast there. You can also download our unique app, Place to Be Nation Podcast. You go to placetobe.podbean.com/mobile on your iPhone and iPad, and it has all the episodes right there in a feed for you, nice and easy. You can also find a special ROH edition of the show on occasion at ROHWrestling.com. And as Kevin mentioned, you can follow us at Twitter, place2bnation, and at RealKevinKelly, facebook.com/placetobenation as well.
All right, fans, you've asked for it, and we have done it. The long-awaited interview here on the Place to Be Nation on the Kevin Kelly Show with Dennis Stamp. Dennis, it is great to talk to you here on the air. You have no idea how popular you are amongst the fans of this show.
Well, that is awfully, awfully nice to hear. I'm sure, for me, speechless is not a working term, but an introduction like that really, really gives me pause to think about it. I appreciate it. So,
well, it's so true. And again, you went from being, in many wrestling fans' eyes, you know, someone that a lot of folks didn't know because you were, you know, you had wrestled maybe 10 or 15 years or so before any of the younger fans had seen you, to now somebody because of Beyond the Mat, to where a lot of fans see you for the first time today, yesterday, the popularity of that movie and sort of the cult favorite that you became.
You know, that's a hard thing for me to believe that the movie has still got traction and people are still watching the movie
all the time.
Oh man.
We'll put it to you this way. When we announced that, cause you and I spoke on the phone Sunday night.
Sure.
So as soon as we made the announcement that Dennis Stamp was going to be on the show, we put it up on Twitter, and the response that we got, and I had told you, we've had everybody on the show from AJ Styles to Matt Hardy to Diamond Dallas Page to Dr. Tom Pritchard. We've had the announcer for the Boston Bruins. We've had all sorts of different folks, but we hadn't gotten more positive feedback than when we made the announcement about Dennis Stamp. And that is all because of that cameo appearance that you had in Beyond the Mat. How did that come to be? How did you find your way into that Barry Blaustein movie? Because I had a walkthrough. You saw my purple shirt in one of the scenes with Mick Foley backstage in a WWF event. So how did you come to wind up on in that famous documentary?
I've been accused of stealing the show. As a matter of fact, before the premiere, Terry Funk's wife was mad at me.
Really?
Yeah, because she said I stole Terry's segment. Now Terry and I couldn't be any closer. I mean, when he tells me he loves me and I tell him I love him, it's just like a couple. I mean, that's how close we are as far as how we feel about each other. There's not we don't see each other very often anymore, but the bond is unbreakable. I mean, it's just so strong and so positive that we can still tease each other, you know. And so he disclaims that. He says no, but he has come to find out that little set tee we had, the little talk with where I'm not booked and so forth that we had, really was a highlight of the movie, I think. And so he was a part of it. And so here's the thing. He called me up and he said, okay, Dennis, they're going to make a movie about, no, here's what he, here's how he approached me. Terry Funk called me and he said, Dennis, would you like to be in a good movie? That was a question he asked me. Would you like to be in a good movie? And I said, Terry, I'd probably like to be in a bad movie. Are you kidding me? I'd be in any movie. Give me a break here. So then he explained about the concept of Beyond the Mat. And that the producer was going to come to town and if it was all right, he'd like him to talk to me. If I would talk to him. I said, sure, Terry, what do you want me to say? He's taken aback by that. He says, oh, no, you say anything you want. You know, I was used to the wrestling format. Not that I ever had anybody tell me what to say, but they would generally, you know. But I thought, you know, here's a movie and here's what. And he said, no, say anything you want. So we went out and he said, where can we do it? So we went out to the Big Texan, which I don't know, it's a big steakhouse here on the edge of town where they have a 72-ounce steak and they have a rattlesnake and they have all kind of stuff, you know. So then he brought in a camera crew. They filmed what was, and I said this at the time, Terry Funk's first. I was the only one that put the first in there. Retirement match. And so they had all the crew in town. So they just did interviews. And so they had one of the producers interview me. And, you know, I really need to, I mean, I should be more modest than this, but I'm going to tell you the truth. When the producer, the woman that interviewed me, told me, she said that they had interviewed probably around 150 wrestlers, and that I was the best interview they had. She said, you were far and away the best interview of all the people we've interviewed. So, but they didn't use any of that. They didn't use any of that stuff that she did. All my best stuff was on the floor.
That's the way it always is, man. That's the way Hollywood gets you.
So the part, I was almost embarrassed by the part of the little conversation that Terry and I had about not being booked. And one of my daughters, my middle daughter, is an administrator of an American school in Korea. She is the administrator. She is the dean of academics. She's a big shot. And so she was teaching in, I don't know, where was she? Bulgaria at the time when the movie came out. And so they had all these international teachers watched it. And these are people with their master's degrees and mostly older people and academic, I call them anyway. They live in academia. They're a different world. Anyway, they told her that I was a drama queen from that movie. She said, oh, your father was just a drama queen. So I didn't really get critical acclaim by any means.
I would beg to differ from those. They probably missed the whole concept of the movie. They probably didn't understand it because probably professional wrestling and Beyond the Mat was being there in academia.
For the unwashed, that's entertainment for the unwashed masses.
Right.
So they have to keep up the pretense that they're above it, you know. If
sure.
anybody liked it, they wouldn't have dare said so because then they would have looked stupid to the rest.
And we've always said, right, guys that have been around for a while always are like, and those are the people that go home and watch wrestling and don't tell anybody about it. They're the closet fans.
Yeah, I know.
Right.
I know.
Hey, how did you get to know Terry Funk? How did you guys become such close friends?
Well, when I got fired the second time in Los Angeles.
What year was that?
That would have been 1970. That was 1976, the second time I got fired.
Okay.
First time I got fired was 75. I wanted to be a heel. You know, I wrestled in high school and college, and I mean, I don't think that there was a better babyface than me, really. But in the regional territory system, you had to be a sacred cow. If you weren't a sacred cow, you were fourth or fifth on the babyface list. You know, you couldn't ever get anywhere near the top. So I wanted to be a heel because then you could work with all the sacred cows and. You know, so I came to, I wanted to go to Amarillo. The thing was, Amarillo was a territory where at the time, in the early 70s, by this time, Dory Sr. had passed away. But at one time, they said, you don't want to go to Amarillo as a babyface because you got the four Funks. You got Dory Sr., Dory Jr., Terry, and then Ricky Romero. So with only one town a night, you know, you didn't have much chance. So that's how I came to Amarillo, and this is where Terry, actually, he and his brother owned the territory at that time. And so I actually worked for them. But then I got a chance to Terry, that was the year that Terry was the world champion, the NWA champion.
Right.
Not a lot. But I got to wrestle him as world champion. I got to wrestle him 5 times as world champion. Okay, can I work? 3 of the matches we had were our draws. I'd say Broadway, but that's an inside term.
Right, we don't say inside terms on this show.
3 matches that we had with I did three hour matches with Terry as world champion. So, and I can tell you that those were, I mean, golly, it would have been like a 10-year-old kid at Six Flags over someplace, or Disney World for the first time. I mean, it was just like riding all the highest rides and the highest highs and the biggest thrills you could imagine. Can you imagine to think to be with the world champion, to be with the best in the world, and have him treat you like you're his absolute equal, and then make me even look better than he looked. When I walked out of the ring in Odessa, these girls followed me back to dressing room and said, "Terry Funk better never show his face in Odessa, Texas again after that beating you gave him." You know, so it was, yeah, Terry and I have a special bond. And see, that never goes away. That bond, that magic we created in the ring, is so special between he and I. It's a bond. In one of my stories I write about, I had a, I can preview it a little bit, I guess. I had a,
well, you got it.
A bout with cancer a couple of years ago.
We're going to talk about, we got to talk about the fact that you've written a book and okay. And that was one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on now, is to talk about the book. So this would be a good chance to do that. Now, what made you decide to write this book at this time?
Well, I've always considered myself a writer. I wrote 3 short stories 35 years ago, and they're all really good, and they're still good to this day. But they're fictional. They're fictionalized versions. They're fictionalized versions of professional wrestling, which is already a fictionalized version of wrestling. So you can't go there. It's where you can go, but they're still good stories. So I always knew I always thought I was a writer. So I wanted to write. Actually, I was so true to kayfabe, I couldn't vary from it. Until Vince came out to the New Jersey legislature and proclaimed professional wrestling to be wrestling entertainment. Once he did that, it kind of loosened me up a little bit. So the reason I wrote were stories, but they're true stories. And I wanted to give the reason, I'm a storyteller, basically. I'm a storyteller for sure. Absolutely, no question. That's one of the reasons I love being in the ring so much, because I was my story. I love both. Now, you can give me whatever you want in the ring, I'll take it and make a story out of it. But so I've always been a storyteller, or at least since I've been a wrestler anyway. I've been a storyteller, and I've been a wrestler since I was 13, so. I've been a storyteller all my life, but I wanted to give a little of the inside. I wanted to tell the story, some of these things that happened to me from the inside, and which I would have thought that wrestling fans would enjoy because they understand it better. But I thought that I could tell them in such a way that anyone would understand them and like them, you know. Now, I like them, but what am I going to say? they're my stories. I give you an example. It's funny. My brother and sister helped me with them because they're all really computer literate and they're typing and they do all these things and they're helping me out. And my brother had brought, I do some poems, which I might read you a couple of them here, but I do, but he had copies. He has all these copies and he's really a really good guy. And so organized. I'm not as organized as he is. So he takes one of the poems that he's going to make pick some mistakes on it, and he dog-eared one of the corners. I go, "What?" I screamed, "What are you doing?" He goes, "I thought this was my work copy." Oh, I said, "Oh, Tom, I'm sorry. I'm sorry." I said, "They're just like my babies. They're like my children."
Yeah.
These stories, and so I am absolutely proud of them, without question.
Well, the book is called The Stamp Collection, a collection of short stories from the world's most famous unknown wrestler.
now I'll give Chris due credit for that.
That's good. And I think it's a great eye-catching title, but the Stamp Collection, it is that collection of short stories. Now, and I just posted a link to where you can order the book on Amazon.com. I just posted that on Twitter, and we'll have that on the Place to Be Nation page as well, so fans can check that out and order one for themselves. Now, you mentioned that you've got some poetry that you've written.
Okay, let me just tell you one quick on the story.
Oh, now, tell me.
Everybody told me, you don't write short stories. You write one book. I said, the truest form of storytelling are short stories. I don't put in a lot of flowery descriptions of things. It's just the facts. It's all you need, you know. But probably I would say that, if anything, my stories have been influenced by my matches. You know, they have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
And it's funny because sometimes I would know how a story ended and then I would work to the end. But almost without exception, the story has a life of its own and it either goes in a different direction or it ends differently than what I thought it was going to start out with. But
which is kind of like a match.
Exactly.
Sometimes you think, you know where you want to get to, you know what you're supposed to get to. But the way you get there is kind of up to your interpretation and your opponents.
And what I would do is I just set my emotions on feel and on flow. Set my emotions on flow. Okay, if you make me mad, I'm going to be really mad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a part of the match. It's a part of the match. And I'll go wherever it takes. You know, I'll go wherever the match takes me is where we'll go. And I might have never been there before. But likely I have, but sometimes I don't, you know. And I would never, I have maybe close to 2,000 matches, and there's going to be similarities all the way through, but I never had the same match twice, ever.
You told me the other night when we spoke on the phone that there's some matches and some occasions where you've seen posters or things like that, and you had absolutely no recollection of that match, of that opponent.
And I think part of that is, I was thinking about that too. And I think the thing about, you know, with baseball and others where all the statistics, where the wrestling, there's no yesterday. With professional wrestling, there's no yesterday. We got to forget yesterday because you already lost yesterday. It's a whole new world today. We got all the same players, but it's a whole new world. So we're starting all over. We're not going to say that that guy beat you 37 times in the last year and a half. We're not going to say that. So forget it. We don't go there.
Right.
Go forward. So that was sort of my mindset during that time of going forward. So if something didn't really strike me or it bored me worse, then it would be out of my mind. I would let it go. I didn't want to keep it. I didn't want to keep it in my mind. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the things I write about are matches. One of the matches, I can give you the actual date. I mean, it's dated from when it happened, and it was October 30th, 1976. So that's a long time ago. But I can go right through that match almost move for move.
And who was that match? Who was that match against?
Dory Funk Jr.
Ah.
But the special, what made it special at that time is Coco, eccentric, Bon Vivian, the man who planted the Cadillacs in the ground, this multi-millionaire, refereed the match.
Ah, so that made it.
Hunter. He was a big game hunter, and yeah, and so here's this guy. That time he's worth $60 million. So who knows? That might be $60 billion. But
yeah, $60 million in $60 million in 76. That was doing something back then.
And I know because they kept coming in the dressing room and telling me now don't touch the referee. Don't touch the referee, Stamp. Don't hurt him. You don't hurt him. You don't hit him. You don't touch him. You know, on and on. He's worth $60 million. You don't touch him. You don't get near him. So I was a little nervous. It made me a little nervous, but it turned out to be just an unbelievable match. And it's one of my stories. It's called The Match. It's one of the stories that I've written in. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to take people into the ring with me and go through the things that I was doing and why, you know, like I'd get hit and then I'd hit back and what I would do and how I reacted and why I was, you know, to try to take the people into the ring with me a little bit, because that's, I can tell you this, and I did put this on one of my, I've got poems recorded on CDs too. I've had two lifetimes. One inside the ring, and then the rest of the time. So that's how I feel about that.
Yeah. How did you? I was just going to ask the balance of those two lives. That's proven to be rather challenging for some of your brethren, for probably most of your brethren.
It hasn't been easy. It is not easy at all. And that's one of the things I can say that writing is therapeutic. And people can do what they want. Probably most people would, I guess typewriters are passe now, but keyboards and computers, most people do it on computer, I would think. Me, I do it in a spiral notebook with a big pen.
Wow.
You know, but I write and I write and I write, and could write, I don't know, 2-3 pages in a day. And then I might go back and cross out half of it, or maybe tear up all of it. Try not to tear it up though, because I like to keep it. Even though I have a tendency to try to throw them away, but I'll keep it. The spiral notebook makes it easier to keep it. Just turn the page. Just turn the page and start over, do something else, write over it. I've got so many things that are crossed out and rewritten and so forth. But believe me, you can get out of the ring, but you'll never get the roar of the crowd out of your ears. I mean, I'm no drug addict by any means. I tried a lot of different stuff at different times, but there's no high in the world like a live audience. There's nothing that can touch it. And it's one reason why there's so many of the guys that go off into drugs and have problems. It's not just wrestlers. Look at football players. It's singers. It's anybody that performs in front of an audience. It's boy, it's so hard to give up. And so, my storytelling, I thought, well, the one thing, you know, people always like my stories. Even when we used to make all the trips were by car, and we would almost always, it'd be 200-300 miles every day to drive somewhere, sometimes 200-300 and back. And so we spent so much time together in the car, especially late at night. And I put everybody to sleep at one time or another with my stories. one of the things, and I say
that's
maybe,
good. That's good as long as one of those people isn't the driver.
Yeah, I always ended up driving. I would be the only person at 2 o'clock in the morning. I would be the one person that was still awake.
Yeah,
and it had everybody else put to sleep. But here, I tell you what, Kevin. I'll try this one time, this one thing here, if you don't mind, and we'll see what you think.
Okay.
What I've done, I've got some poems. I wrote some poems about wrestlers. Now, most of them are just short stories that rhyme, and they're basically stories. Anyway, this one is titled Hitman. I had his first match, the kid, Bret Hart. He may have been 15, too young to start. He was worried that I might tear him apart. His body to the hospital, we'd have to cart. I tried in the dressing room to settle him down. He said he was afraid he'd look like a clown. Funk told him, don't worry, Stamp's the best around. He'll make you look like the toast of the town. Little did I know, his future would be bright. The scrawny young kid in the ring that night. He sure didn't put up much of a fight. I said, come on, Brett, let's do this right. I told him, get down on one knee. Just make a fist and point it at me. There was one thing I didn't foresee. He threw it too low, if you know what I mean. He thought I'd be mad. I said, it's okay. You didn't know how to punch anyway. From your first match, no one could ever say that Bret Hart would be world champion one day. Dennis Stamp. The Stamp Collection.
That, Dennis, that is incredible. That is really, that's beautiful poetry. And what an amazing point of view you have being in there for Bret Hart's first match. I mean, that's incredible. Wow.
I got to say this one time because I've never said it before on any record. I got his cherry. Okay,
well,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say because the intersection between Bret Hart and Terry Funk we saw in Beyond the Mat, and if you didn't know the details,
okay. So then I got to give you the rest of it.
Okay,
so I have the match with I referee Terry's match with Bret Hart, which he knows the whole story. You know, he knows that he punched me. He punched me right between the legs. He knows that. And so we do one thing where he just pushes me. It's like two-hand push on my chest.
Mm-hmm.
It hurt for a week.
Damn, he was stiff.
I wanted to have a match. I thought I wanted to have a match. I'm out there as a referee, and I just get shoved, and it hurt for a week. So I got to keep it in context. You know, I don't want people to think that I think that I'm tougher than the hitman. The hitman is tougher than this old man. Still, I'm sure of that.
Well, from a 15-year-old kid having his first match with you to then being, you know, the world champion, what an amazing journey along the way. Now, when did you? So we know Bret Hart's first match, but when did you have your first match? How old were you? Where was it?
Well, it was Thunder Bay, Ontario, and it was August 9th, 1971. I was Vern Gagne had started me, and when he started people at that time, they would referee and set up the ring, and then until it was time to have the first match, and he said, it's going to be way out somewhere in Thunder Bay, Ontario. But what a macho sounding place. Thunder Bay. Okay, this is one of my favorite poems, okay?
Okay.
It's called Andre. When I was a boy, I'd never believe that in my life a real giant I'd meet. He had a big head, big hands, and big feet. He had a huge heart. The man was real sweet. After the matches one Friday night, we'd gotten out early to our delight. Then Andre said, let's go eat a bite. When the giant said jump, We said, how high? After we ate, we went to the bar. That's when I should have got into my car. But it was too late. I didn't get far. The giant had picked me up off the floor. The table was soon filled with cans of beer. The giant then said, no one leaves here. Not until this whole table is clear. After that, you'll have nothing to fear. I drank too much beer. I passed out, you know. So up on the giant's shoulder I go. He carried me up to my room, I was told. Since then, only turkey. I take mine cold.
That's awesome.
How many people do you think have been carried up the stairs to their room over the shoulder of a giant?
There's probably like a veritable who's who in the wrestling business of guys that when you hear about Andre, you hear stories about him. It was always, you drink with me, boss. Come on, you drink with me. And it was, life was a party when Andre would come to the territory, wasn't it?
But you could not say no.
Right.
I asked Terry. Terry one time flew with him to Tokyo. So from San Francisco to Tokyo, you know, that's quite, I don't know, 8 hours, something like that, 10. So he said he wanted to watch a movie, Terry. For sure. So he carries around with him The Princess Bride.
Ah.
You know that movie he was in?
Oh, yeah.
So he watched it, and it was over, and he says, you want to watch it again? So he played it again. So he went, it's over the second time. He says, you want to watch another movie? So he put it on again. He played the movie the whole trip from San Francisco to Tokyo. And I asked Terry, I said, Terry, I said, I wasn't lying, was I? I said, you can't say no. You couldn't say no to the giant.
Yeah.
He says, no. He says, you couldn't. And I know you've been around him, and I asked Terry, and I've been around him. I was around him a lot. I have never heard of him ever bothering anybody, ever fighting anybody or hitting anybody or hurting anybody in any way. But you didn't say no to him.
Right. Exactly. I interviewed Tully Blanchard a few years ago, and Tully talked about flying on a plane with him. But it was like, you know, an early morning, 7 a.m. flight, and he's sitting across from Andre in first class, and he says, you drink with me, boss. And I was like, and it was like the last words he wanted to hear at 7 o'clock in the morning. Okay, you got it. So Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary before they even took off. And he doesn't remember the flight. He just remembers the beginning. Yeah. He says he was sure that there was probably some turbulence along the way, but he doesn't remember any of that. But that was the common theme. Nobody could say no to Andre. And yeah. he was just remarkable.
He would have a magnum of wine in the dressing room.
Golly.
Magnum.
And it'd
be gone before he left.
Exactly.
And no one ever said, not one promoter, not one person ever said one word to him about it. You know, there are always on people's ass about drinking and everything else.
Yeah, of course.
Not the giant. Nobody ever said anything to the giant.
So you had gotten fired two different times from working in L.A. How did you get fired? What did you do?
Okay, here's what happened. I went to L.A. with Louis Tellet, and we went in after the John Tolis, and people had just burned it down. They ran every other week, and they had $2,800. Can you imagine Los Angeles? $2,800 when we went in there. And jeez. So I worked my ass off. I would be in two and three matches on every night, every card, two and three interviews. We had two 90-minute live television shows. One was on the Spanish network, played all over the world. And I just got better and better. And we ran weekly instead of every other week. And it got up, I was one of the people there, who was up to 14,600.
Now,
from 2,800.
And for what fans...
14,000 a week.
That's amazing. What fans may not understand, when Dennis came in, that means the house, the paid attendance totaled $2,800. And he had gotten the paid attendance, now running biweekly, $2,800, to now running every week, got it over $14,000. That means a significant increase of attendance, because tickets were probably what, $2, $3?
No, they would be $5, $6, $7.
Okay, but still,
at that time.
We're not talking. We're not talking $20 tickets.
We're talking half a house. Almost. We're talking. That's a bad Olympic Auditorium. It was built for the 1932 Olympics. It's one of the best buildings I was ever in, because it was built perfectly for a ring in the middle.
Right.
It was built for boxing and wrestling, and it held 10,000 people. But anyway, Louis wanted me to be a stooge. I was assistant booker. And if there was a problem, I would fix it. If there was, you know, so Louis calls me and he says, I had you running the towns, but I didn't know anything that was going on. I said, Louis, what do you mean? You know, I knew what he meant. He said, I want to know every word that's said in the dressing room. Because, you know, I'd say, this is what Louis wants. And they'd say, that asshole. You know, they wouldn't. You know how people are going to talk.
Right.
And the boss isn't there. It's only natural. So Leo Garibaldi had come in. Well, this is a stooge deluxe. and he would stand behind the door. We got to where we'd feed him stuff. Because we'd stand behind the door. They were really on underage girls at that time. I was in my middle 20s, but I didn't mess with them anyway. But they're always around. Some of the guys do, you know them. So we'd feed them with that. We'd say, oh, yeah. Oh, is she 15? Dang, I thought she was only 14. I mean, it's almost like a comedy album we're doing. And
you
go back and tell Louis. So anyway, Garibaldi was hooked up with the Guerreros. Now we're in Los Angeles, right? And this is the middle 70s. Okay, and the Guerreros are all midgets. And I'm not. And I'm over like $1 million. The guy in the office said something about fan mail one time, and I said, fan mail? We get fan mail? He says, you're the only one that gets any fan mail. I go, why don't I get it? I said, what do you do with it? He said, we just throw it away.
Oh.
I said, why do you do that? I know why they didn't want me to think that I was popular.
Right, because now you're going to ask for more money.
they threw mine at the fifth way. So anyway, they finally decided, oh, this is one of my stories. I did this thing with Brian Gumbel. You must know Brian Gumbel.
Of course.
I did this thing with Brian Gumbel. That's one of my stories. That's one of my stories.
And he started his career in Los Angeles, right?
KNBC.
Yep.
And I did a segment with Brian Gumbel where he had his own segment. They had 90-minute news. They had 30 minutes of the national network news, and then they had their own 60-minute of local news. So he had time for segments. So he had a segment called Be What You Want to Be. So people could write in, and then somebody wanted to be a mayor. They found a little town where a guy was a mayor for a day. Somebody wanted to be a fireman. They get to ride on a truck or something. This was first class. Somebody wanted to be a baseball player. They took him out to Dodger Stadium and let him hit batting practice. And they'd film, you know. So somebody wanted to be a wrestler, right? So they come to the Olympic, and Mike LaBelle and Louis Tillet and ask about it. And so, are there any volunteers? There's only one volunteer. There's only one person that would do it, and that's me. And so, it's a guy sight unseen, 6'2", 250 pounds. And on my way to, and LaBelle's tell me, Brian Gumbel said, you know, we don't want you to hurt him. Louis Tillet, on my way to the ring, he says, I want a broken bone. You break an arm or a leg, I don't care.
Wow.
On my way to, and now, there's nobody in the building except the camera crew, Brian Gumbel, and this guy's wife and six-month-old baby are sitting at ringside. They're the only ones sitting in the seats. Now, the wrestlers are all there, but they're hiding. They're all in hiding. So I had this guy, turned him every way but loose. I had him tap out or basically screamed out about three times. I would essentially pinned him two or three more times. I just played with him, you know, just dominated him. But everybody was pissed. Everybody was mad because I didn't break any bones, because I didn't take any blood, you know. So Louis wouldn't even speak to me. And the wrestlers were all on my back. I got the silent treatment, which only lasted, it lasted, they were going to do it for a couple of weeks. It lasted about 3 or 4 days. But they did, you know, I said, screw them. I did the right thing. I knew I did the right thing.
Sure.
Anyway, that got me fired. So, but that was the excuse to fire me. Because what good is a pistol if you can't shoot it?
Right.
If you can't shoot somebody with it, what good is it? So, as a pistol, as an office policeman, the pistol assistant booker, I'm not going to stooge. As a pistol, I'm not going to shoot anyone. What good am I? Yeah. Almost with a bad word slip in there.
Hey, that's okay. Again, this is on the internet. You can say whatever you want.
So, but I'm going to maintain my civility the best. And something might slip out, but I won't. I'm trying to keep it as clean as possible. But anyway, here's the deal. The Garibaldi was connected with the Four Guerreros, and that would have been Chavo, which Chavo, who would be in his 60s, and then his brothers. And so Mike LaBelle was the only one that was really honest with me, because he said, here's a problem, Dennis. He said, who are the fans going to, we're bringing in the Guerreros because we really want to cater to the Mexican audience. Because look, we're right here in Los Angeles. Hey, we brought it up with, I mean, we had it steady. No, I have to explain it. And he said, the problem is you're going to make the Guerreros look small.
Yeah.
So I was gone. And then next time I got Kaminsky. If you can believe this, I got fired in Vancouver by Gene Kaninsky, and Vancouver had to be the last outpost of the whole, you know, of civilization. It was so horrible. And, but he wanted me to put over the guy. Okay, in 1964, there was a James Bond movie. I think it was Dr. No, one of the James Bond movies, where they had the little Japanese guy with had the derby with steel in the rim of the hat.
Right.
And he was old then. And so now here's 1975, and he's in his 60s. I'm in my 20s, and he wants me to put him over. So
he wanted you to put Odd Job over, huh?
Odd Job. So Odd Job, yeah, that's how I got fired in British Columbia. I said, he says, wait, why not? I said, he's old, he's small, and he's slow. I said, you got a bad attitude, kid. I said, you need to find some other place to work. All right, then.
I do know jobs for Odd Job. And then you left.
I did. Well, I did it, though. I mean, I did.
Oh,
it.
You did, but.
I did. I did it under protest, but I did it. I never didn't do it. I never didn't do a job.
Nah, okay. And go ahead. I don't mean to interrupt your flow, because you're doing great. We're again. We'll give everybody the opportunity to order the book, because I want to make sure everybody gets this. The stamp collection. You'll see the link on the Place Be Nation page. The stamp collection available now, Amazon.com and anywhere else you could find books. So
that's kind of the gist of, actually, I just gave away one of my stories, because it's the one about Brian Gumbel. That pretty much is what that one's about. I think that I want to do one more poem.
Okay.
You okay? Okay. This one is Ode to Terry. For Terry Funk, they had a roast. The wrestlers came from coast to coast to see who could lay on the most and give it to our special host. He's tough as nails, but he's not mean. He carries himself with real esteem. His love of life is very keen. He brings joy to every scene. If you wrestled Terry, you would know he'd be the best match on the show. Getting to the ring, he may be slow, but once he's there, it's go, go, go. The matches with Terry are always great. Love him or hate him, but make no mistake. Such violence and mayhem he does create. To see him, leave early and don't be late. As a person, Terry has so much class. For that of a gentleman, he'd surely pass. To my dear friend Terry, I raise my glass in toasting a man that has kicked my ass.
That's beautiful, Dennis. That's really awesome. When I first got to meet Terry, oh gosh, I was in the WWE, and it was like 1998. So it was around the time of the, you know, Beyond the Mat, around that time frame. And
oh yeah, yeah.
He was still going strong then, and still is today. What you knew Dory so well, you knew Terry so well, and their father always had a. I would have loved to have met Senior, just because his reputation.
That's the one person in the world of wrestling that I would love to have met.
I know that because I've read a lot of the things that Dory Funk has written over the years, and I appreciate his writing ability a great deal. They talk
very
with such,
man.
Yeah, such reverence. They speak about their father. It was, of all the greats, and you had talked to me about this the other night about kind of your Mount Rushmore of wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Go through that list for the listeners, because I think they'll appreciate your insight.
Okay. Well, and it's my perspective. And as I was thinking today about the people that I left off, I want to say that there are so many people inside the business that I have respect for and that I look up to and that it's got to be my top five. My top five starts with, it's like the reason I'm, the analogy is, one day on the ESPN show, they had the Mount Rushmore of wide receivers of the NFL, you know. So I thought, what about the Mount Rushmore of professional wrestling? Some other local show had said that. So I thought, well, what would mine be? So I start out this way. I start with Andre the Giant, and he is the mountain, actually. There's no buddy in my lifetime of 68 years, there's no one that compares to him physically. And I mean, Bill Watts or somebody came up with him being the eighth wonder of the world. And the longer I live, the more I believe that.
Right.
He was truly the eighth wonder of the world. So anyway, we started with the Giant. He's the mountain. On his right shoulder would have to be Hulk Hogan, because he is the most popular wrestler still to this day, period. You can ask anybody who know, people that don't even know anything about wrestling know who Hulk Hogan is. So he just transcends life. He is the wrestler. On the other shoulder, I have Dusty Rhodes. I consider him to be the most talented. Now, is he flawed? We're all flawed, but I consider Dusty Rhodes to be just an he was just too much. And then the other two on my mountain, then the other two would be Dory Funk Jr. and Terry Funk. I consider that I met two geniuses in the business, one being Dory Funk Jr., the other one being the late Eddie Graham. But Dory Funk Jr., far and away my idol. I idolized him. I still do. The things that he did when he was the world champion, which was prior to Terry, so it would have been the early 70s, like maybe 73, 74, and 75.
Yeah, he beat Kaniski. He beat Kaniski for the belt in Tampa, and then he lost it to Jack Briscoe.
Actually, he lost it to Harley. Harley changed the belt both times with both Funk.
Did he really? Okay, I'm sorry. I always had that. Oh, so Jack
Harley
never
lost.
Beat
Jack. Jack never. I don't think
that's right.
Ever beat Dory Jr.
That's right. That's right. It was Harley because Harley lost to both. Harley won the belt from both Dory
both
and yeah, exactly.
Very
interesting. And, okay.
So I So, see, I know my history.
Yeah, you do. You know it better than me because you were there. You lived it. And Kaniski popped into my mind because he had fired you.
Kaniski is an idiot. So, I like him. But I still, I mean, and another thing, he's a brother. I mean, it's a brotherhood. You're a brother. I mean, it's a brotherhood. And it's a tight, tight clique. And it doesn't matter. You could hate somebody's guts. If you could come in contact, personal contact with him, it's like, oh my God, it's like my greatest girlfriend from high school or something. When Terry and I get together, it's just my stomach, my sides will hurt afterwards because we laugh the whole time. I mean, it's just so special. But anyway, the thing about Dory, he made everybody look so good. When he was champion, he made everybody look so good. And the one I can tell you that just absolutely blew my mind was he did a 60 minute match with Grizzly Smith.
Oh my gosh.
The most uncoordinated person maybe I've ever seen in the ring. And he made him look like Tinkerbell virtually. And I've never forgot that match. I watched the whole thing. That's what I would do. I would watch all the matches. I would watch every match I could possibly watch. And I was on television all the time. I would watch all my matches when I could. And I hated it, but I did. I'd force myself to watch them because I wanted to see anything that didn't look right. I want to change. I want to fix anything. One of my friends was watching. We're sitting watching a match. And I was here in Amarillo, and he looks at me, and he looks at my shirt, and I'm just soaked under my arms. I'm just soaked. He goes, "You sweat more watching that match than you did wrestling that match." So, you know, so that I think that I consider myself fairly perceptive, so that I could I could see things and figure things out. So I should be able to write about it. I should be able to tell stories. My problem telling stories orally generally is I'm too wordy, and I go off on tangents and then never come back to the original story. So write them down.
You got a future as a podcast host then, let me tell you, Dennis, because that's kind of the job. You start a story and you go off into left field and you don't come back. It's fine.
You know, the thing I want to give credit to Chris Duke. I want to give thanks to Chris Duke. Okay. It would have been, because I'll never forget, because when I saw the date on the broom in the hospital, it gave me a little bit of a chill because it was November 22nd. And that's the day when Kennedy was killed. So it was November 22nd that I go in the hospital with 300. My pulse was 300.
Oh my gosh.
And I had fourth stage fast growing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I had tumors all over my body. Matter of fact, they'd assigned me hospice. They couldn't almost decide whether they wanted to mess with me or just write me off to hospice.
And what year was this?
It would have been 3 years ago, November 22nd. So
okay.
It was 2011.
Yep.
So, anyway, here I am. I'm still here. I'm still kicking. Anyway, so after that, and I can tell you that as bad as the cancer was, the chemotherapy was probably worse. But anyway, without the chemo, I wouldn't be here. So I have to thank the chemo for that, or thank them or whatever. And anyway, so I was this Chris Duke had a radio show, a wrestling radio show, in Scotland, in Glasgow, Scotland, on a little station. And so he had me on his show. I was on his show 20 weeks in a row, and he created a little segment called Stamp Stories. So he said, we can do 5 minutes. So after the first show, I'd gone about 10 and 12 and 15. And I said, "Chris, we need to try to hold this to 10 minutes because I don't want to steal your show. Plus, I don't want to wear out my welcome." So I didn't tell any. I told stories every week, but none of the ones I've written. But I told a lot of my next foray into writing probably would be. Now, I've got fiction stories that I'd love to write, but nobody's going to pay any attention until I can establish myself as a writer. But I do want to write about my time in Las Vegas because I was the head jabroni for the AWA. And so I was had about a 3-year run there where we were at the Showboat once a month. And I was there just about every time they had a show, I was there. And they would do this. They'd make 4 tapes, so they'd bring us in. Now, I'd love to do it. I get a plane ticket, supposedly a room. It might be 7 other guys might have the same room, and $150. So if you're on 1 tape, you get $150. If you're on 2, 3, 4 tapes, you still get only $150. They say, well, we're only going to have you on 1 tape. Maybe sometimes we'll have you on 2. Well, I was never on less than 2, and it was usually 3 and sometimes 4. Several times it was 4, all 4 tapes. In fact, I can remember one time, and I don't know, I had Crusher Blackwell, and I had, I don't know, Zabisco, and I had different people, and they were just all wanting to squash me, so they were. And Crusher Blackwell, you know, 5'8", and like 500 pounds.
Yeah, right. Oh.
Pounds, and he's going to do a press slam. He said, but you won't feel it. Oh, my God. I was like a pancake. He really squashed me. But how could he not with all that weight? Anyway, so I'm back in the dressing room. That was my 3rd match. So I'm back in the dressing room, and I'm in the chair. I'm just sitting in a folding chair because I can't move. I should take a shower. You know, I want to go. I'm in Vegas. I want to do something, but I got to go home in the morning anyway. So, but I can't move. I'm just totally squashed. So Ray Stevens, the booker, or in that dressing room anyway. So he comes over to me and says, Dennis, you got to go on. You got to go on again. I said, Ray, I don't even know if I can stand up. He goes, you got to use somebody else. He said, look around, my friend. He and I were the only 2 people in the dressing room. I was the only one left. I was the only one left. And they had one more match they had to put on. So I said, okay. We'll see. So I went and put my head under the faucet and pushed my hair all back, which is all sweat and messed, and combed my hair back and put a jacket back on. So I barely could hardly just kind of amble along. But it's amazing. As soon as I got into view of the crowd, they started in with this heavy-duty booing me. Because, you know, I'm a villain. And they're just really on me, booing me. And my initial thought was, where have these people... Well, I didn't say people. I'll say people now. Where have these people been for the last 3 matches? How can they possibly boo me? I've been done nothing but been destroyed for 3 straight matches till they practically had to scrape me off the mat the last time, and they're booing me. But my initial thought was, how stupid are these people? But then what it did, though, the effect of it was, is like they were putting air in a flat tire. It just pumped me right back up. It just pumped me right back up till I got right back in the ring like I hadn't even been in there before. I mean, that night. So it's funny how it goes. And it was another time where I did all 4. There was one morning after that. That might have been that time. I had to virtually roll out of bed in the morning and crawl to the bathtub and put the water on as hot as I could possibly stand it, just to be able to move around.
Oh, boy.
You know, it's one thing when I was doing it every day, maybe I was wrestling 10 times a week, yeah, I could have done anything. But then when you don't do it every day, and then when you start doing it once a month, and then you had a few years off, and then you just go back to once a month, and then you can feel, then you feel the body slams and the press slams. I took 2 superflies. Jimmy Snuka, I had wrestled Jimmy Snuka in 1975 in Portland and had taken the superfly, and it was a dream. And then I'm booked with him, and 10 years later, I'm booked with him in Las Vegas to do this. He does the superfly and almost killed me with it. My head hit the canvas so hard. all everything just started spinning around. And Vern was actually doing color commentating. He came in the ring. He came in the ring to make sure I was still alive, I think.
Jeez.
But see how I do with the tangents there. Anyway,
well, that's great, though. I think that those AWA tapings will make a great follow-up book. Dennis, we're just about out of time, but I do want to remind everybody that the stamp collection is now available at Amazon.com, and we'll post links, as we said, on the Place to Be Nation. I want to ask a favor before you go. The other night you shared with me a poem that was that's become your signature catchphrase. It's
right.
If you smell what the rock is cooking, or that's the bottom line because Stone Cold said so. I think one of the most repeated phrases in professional wrestling since the late 90s has been, "I'm not booked." And you wrote a poem about that. And I would ask if you would share that as we wrap things up.
Well, I am. I will tell you that I would be more than proud to do it. And it's of my poems, it is absolutely my favorite. And so, and it's really it's the first one I wrote. And so that has some special feeling for it too. Okay. I'm not booked. I've been hooked and crooked and overlooked. I'm not fully cooked. I'm underbooked. I'm not booked. I'm not booked. Around the world I did look to find the one who took the belt that I forsook, but I'm not booked. The belt was mine to hold. The match had been ice cold. A proud territory had been sold. A championship had been stolen. And I know I'm not too old, but I'm not booked. A main event is a place to be. Anywhere on the card is okay with me. It's not that I'm the best, you see. It's just a match is what I need. But I'm not booked. In dressing rooms everywhere, you will see all the things that I won't be. A stooge, a snitch, or a referee. I would rather work for free, but I'm not booked, than a stamp collection.
There you go. That's about as good as it gets right there, my friend. And I'm glad we had a chance to get to know each other here on the telephone and here on the podcast. And I'm going to stay in contact with you if you don't mind. And we'd love to have you back sometime in the new year. I'm also
going
to
we can do some more poems.
I love it. I want more stories. I want more stuff. I feel we've just begun to scratch the surface. We're going to put you in contact too with the folks at Pro Wrestling Tees. So I have a feeling we'll be able to work out a deal there. And be on the lookout for that as well. You're very welcome. And of course, the stamp collection is available now through Amazon.com. Follow the link. It'll be posted all over the Place to Be Nation website, all over our social media footprint.
I am really proud of those stories. I really am proud of those. I stand by those stories 100%. I think I'm sure if people want to hear me, they would want to read my stories for sure.
Well, absolutely great. And we thank you so much for your time. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you. And we look forward to speaking to you again, okay?
Thank you very much.
All right. That's Dennis Stamp, everybody.